because you conducted a study in Kenya, therefore everybody in Africa have the same stuff or the same composition. So it's quite important to specify the geography and then the cultural and other environmental factors that may impact the microbiome composition of such populations.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organisation also known as ISAP. In this podcast, you'll hear about emerging topics across the fields of biotic substances and microbiome science. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Dan Tancredi.
Hello, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And today we're delighted to be joined by Kingsley Anukam, who is going to talk to us about two very different, but I think underexplored topics, the African fermented foods and also essentially the microbiome of the male reproductive organs, which I think is an area which is also somewhat underrepresented in the literature. So Kingsley, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
I know you have connections to people with ISAP because you trained with Gregor Reid, of course, at some time in your career. And you also work with Dr. Sarah Labir, who's another ISAP board member. So ISAP are very interested in hearing how those two people may have influenced your career. Can you tell us, essentially, give us a very short background on your career?
I was trying to find out the reason why African women were labeled as not having lactobacillus. There was a publication, Antonio, I thought, in 1991, that said that colonization of lactobacilli is associated with being white. So back in Nigeria, when we read the paper, I was really curious. I wanted to know, really, if it is true. So I started making some research, you know, and then tried to contact some people. And luckily, you know, Gregor came into focus. I sent him an email that this is my plan, this is what I plan to do but by then I was at the University of Benin in Benin City, Nigeria. And I was lucky enough, Gregor sent me some papers and then we started collaborating. And in the process, yes, he invited me over to come to his lab in 2004 to process samples from Nigerian women. And that invitation, you know, led to a series of publications and collaborations one of them showed that, in fact, that African women colonized by lactobacilli, which is similar to those found in Caucasian women or every other population that are known as healthy, as I started my career.
Do you have any idea why those early papers thought that African women were not colonized by lactobacilli? Were there some procedural flaws, or do you have any idea why that might have been thought to be the case?
Yes, it's not a procedural flaw per se, but it's the way they frame their questions, kind of, because at the earlier stage, you know, most information that comes out referring to Africans, most of the studies are done in North America, right? Especially Black African women or people. And they try to generalize that to Black people. That is the main thing, you know. And again, some of the confounding factors, they are not taken into consideration. You know, they said in some of the papers that African women, they don't tell you the background. What is the background of these people? They don't mention about it, right? They just, you know, generalizing, well, African women, they are not less likely to be colonized by lactobacillus or some other organisms that have beneficial properties.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously very clear that most of the microbiome research that has been done in, I guess, what we could characterize the West, you know, in Europe and in the US. And there certainly hasn't been enough attention on indigenous populations in other parts of the world. But I still find it extraordinary that they could have drawn such a conclusion when, in fact, as you showed, that is not the case at all.
Yeah, and you've been critical, and rightly so, of race-based science, and have argued that when geography might be relevant, you know, we should talk about biogeography. Can you talk a little bit about how that might have impacted microbiome research, where people have tried to generalize in a racial context when it was very inappropriate?
Yes, thank you very much for that question. Yes, you see, as I said earlier, a lot of geographical variations exist, no doubt, right? And most of the studies that are done kind of based on, or should be based on what is prevalent in that geography, especially some papers published in Kenya, in Tanzania, and some other, in Malawi, some other African countries. Their environment here, their might quality be different compared to what we have in West Africa. So in that situation, you know, again, even diet, it all has a contributing factor. You know, people eat different type of foods, right? And the different way of, even the cultural practices, they probably impact on their microbiome. So when studies of this nature are being conducted, you know, should they, the authors should bear in mind that these factors probably affect the microbiome composition. It's not something that has to be okay, because you conducted a study in Kenya, therefore everybody in Africa have the same stuff or the same composition. So it's quite important to specify the geography and then the cultural and other environmental factors that may impact the microbiome composition of such populations.
You did some interesting characterization of African fermented foods. I wonder, did you come across any foods that were from Eastern Africa or from elsewhere that have now become, like, have either raised scientific questions for you or that you're interested in, you just like to consume them now?
Well, African fermented foods have been in practice over the years, right? And a lot of attention is not paid to African fermented foods, okay? So we don't know much, have much information there. So in my research, there's a paper we published in 2009 with Gregory Reed, right? Mm-hmm. And we just did a review. And we discovered that, especially in the eastern part of Nigeria, there are some traditional production of fermented food known as Owa. It's a protein-rich fermented foods. And most of them have been developed, you know, for to find out, to show that they have a lot of lactobacillus or even some beneficial microbes, but more studies have not been done on them. But in recently, I have used some 16S or next generation sequencing to characterize some most of the African fermented foods, especially the one known as okbehi. It's a condiment. We isolated some lactic acid plantarum species. There are the two of them. So we have done the full genome sequencing. When we look at the annotations and you know and other attributes of that bacteria, we found out that they have potential characteristics that need to be developed even for food fermentation or even industrial applications. So these are the studies that are in the pipeline. Maybe if we get funding, we'll go ahead and do some other investigation on that.
Is there good funding for Nigerian scientists to work on projects that affect the population of Nigeria?
Of course, Nigerian governments, they are burdened with other political and economic issues, and they spend less in education, and you know they hardly fund research. Most of my research studies are funded outside, especially the first studies I did to carry out the genome sequence of Lactobacillus bentosus, the one I isolated from a healthy vagina woman. I got that from 2004 when I visited Gregory, but then when I came back to Nigeria, I applied for funding. It was funded by the World Academy of Sciences, which is based in Italy. So they funded my that study to sequence the full genome of Lactobacillus bentosus KCA1. Other studies are done, kind of funded by the moribund or the liquidated eubiome. In fact, they were really very instrumental to most of the study I've done in 16S array amplicon sequencing. They have funded funded over five of my studies. And then recently, Sri Lanka was quite instrumental in the characterizing most of the organisms we identified in African fermented foods. And we carried out some food genome sequencing in his lab. So basically, funding from Nigeria is non-existent, to my understanding.
And this might be an awkward question, but do you think then that some European or US, Japanese, whatever scientists coming to Africa are exploiting that fact to a degree and, you know, trying to do trials which may be not of the same standard or do lesser, you know, less ethical approval and try and exploit the fact that there's not a lot of research going on in Africa? Do you think that might be happening?
Well, to an extent, because some people have said that, I mean, have used the word, I think they call it parachuting scientists, right? They fly into Africa, collect samples and fly out, right? And then we just hear the results. So, but in reality, it should be the other way around. That if you want to come to Africa to carry out, you try to encourage the local scientists or those scientists who are in Nigeria, so that be able to build capacity to allow them to equally do the analysis and other investigation in Africa, right? Or it's not really germane, you know, flying in, collect samples and fly out, and even carrying out clinical trials without even involving the local communities to know exactly what is being done, and before letting them to participate in the study. I mean, to have access to the results and then all the nitty-gritty involved in conducting the research, most of them don't follow that rule. I'm sure some people might be thinking that, yes, that's really exploitative.
Can you talk about some of your own clinical trials? I know you've been involved in some interesting ones, even things looking at controlling malodor, but also some other trials on unimportant health issues, not necessarily ones that are widely studied. So,
oh, okay. Well, thank you for that question. Yeah, that's the one of the paper we published about, is it 2 years ago now, right? It's still part of the studies funded by UBio for me. I was able to look at the microbiome of Nigerian youth, especially students in tertiary institutions, and we were able to find out their composition of those who use all these health products, you know, trying to control body odor, especially the deodorants and antiperspirants. So in our findings, we discovered there is a great difference. Those who use antiperspirants and deodorants, their skin microbiome is altered, you know, compared to those who don't use it, right? And those who use deodorants and antiperspirants, their microbiome keep on repeating. I mean, they keep on having the same issue of odor, right? Of body odor, of perceived odor.
Yes.
And then we came up with the idea, okay, that those who have less odor, according to the survey, and even from the skin microbiome, most of them have lactobacilli. So we'll be able to find out, yes, even the skin has lactobacilli, right?
Uh-huh. And I think you also found some sex differences in terms of the microbiome and also the response to interventions between the boys and the girls.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Yes, we find the differences. Yes, there's a difference between men and women in their microbiome composition. Yes. But then we went further to find out if really using lactobacilli would benefit the participants, you know. So using the pentosus KCA1, we were able to formulate a topical cream. And they administered it, they used it for 14 days. And we are surprised that the findings show that, yes, the skin, especially the armpits, were recolorized by the lactobacillus, and then most of them had reported disappearance of the odor after some days of using the cream.
Yes, interesting.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And I know you've worked as well a lot on reproductive health and the role of microbes and the microbiome in reproductive health. And as you said earlier, we know that the female vagina is colonized significantly with lactobacilli normally. But yeah, I hadn't really thought about it maybe, but you know, the male reproductive organs haven't been studied to the same extent. Can you tell us some of the things you found when studying the microbiome of semen and of testes and of the male reproductive system?
Several studies have shown that the semen microbiome starts laden with bacteria, right? And then we have proven that even with culture methods, right? Not necessarily with the cysteine or the NGS methods. Right. But then the semen microbiome is kind of dominated by lactobacilli. And of course, that improves semen quality. And that has been shown by several authors, especially papers published by people in Europe and even in North America have shown that semen microbiome dominated by lactobacilli, you know, correspond to semen quality. And again, that equally corroborates our findings, you know, because we did some studies, especially in subjects that are seeking for reproductive health care. So we characterized a large number of people, over 141 samples before we did on that. And we showed that men or couples who are having issues with reproduction, their semen and vagina microbiome is quite different from those who have normal spermic conditions. And interestingly, those who have what I call the infection, because we looked at the semen microbiome. Well, presence of leukocytes kind of, well, is associated with being infected, right? And then we cultured that, and at the same time did the NGS analysis on that. And we found out that most of them having having BV-like organisms like Gardnerella vaginalis, Sneetia, Schutzwolter, and other BV-associated organisms. And so that shows that really semen is not sterile as assumed, you know, previously. Okay. Right. It's been shown by even culture methods and non-culture methods. So. But the in area or other parts of reproductive fat, especially the testes and prostate, few studies have shown have been conducted in that area, and there is no clear cut definition of having a prostatic microbiome or testes microbiome, right? But people are suggesting that there may be a connection between the guts and even on the testes, so they are hypothesizing having a gut Texas, you know, connection. And that makes sense because some studies done in mice, they have shown that when mice, when they're being given some lactobacilli or some other, you know, it changes their androgen level, the testosterone level, and even improve their semen quality. But unfortunately, no human study have been done. So they all depend on the what's been done in mice. So maybe in future, if studies could be done to really establish the testicle, the testicular or prostatic microbiome, that we're able to provide insight on whether the prostates or the testes have microbiome composition, I mean, present there or not.
And Kingsley, we believe, of course, that the lactobacilli in the vagina contribute to a lower pH and therefore help to fight off pathogens. And so we have a kind of a mechanism by which lactobacilli could aid in female reproductive health. What role, or do you have a hypothesis as to what role bacteria in semen could be playing?
Oh, yes. The microbes that could play a very significant role, especially if the semen microbiome, if they are having the normal bacterial business, right? And in that case, they are likely to produce some metabolites that could affect even the female reproductive fat, thereby enhancing more, providing more and every environment for conception to take place. So absolutely, the mechanism there, although kinetic action, it's really very difficult to prove in that area, but some associated studies have been found that the semen, you know, has a lot of impact to play in facilitating normal conception to take place. And again, some studies conducted by some groups have shown that when there is a contamination or when they are doing the IVF procedure, when they find out that some samples might be contaminated, they find it difficult to achieve a conception, you know. And again, some studies have shown that even some microbes might get attached to this spermatozoa, right, in the process. And so some of them might equally affect, especially if some pathogens are part of the thing that might attach to the semen microbiome, it might affect the conception in taking place. So absolutely, that's a very clear-cut case to show that, yes, if the semen microbiome is infected with some pathogens, it affects the normal conception to take place. And if they are having a normal microbiota, they are likely to have a successful reproductive outcome.
Can you talk a little bit, you've already touched on some of the connections for a possible gut testes axis. Are there any additional mechanisms there you'd like to touch on, like either endotoxin or the role of diet and nutrition on metabolism, or the communication from the androgen back to the health of the gut?
Yes, there is a connection, especially the gut axis, maybe even testes and the vagina, of course. The androgen and other communicating factors will be affected, especially the intestinal epithelium, at least to maintain the homeostasis and even the immune regulation. There are some studies, you know, looking at even microRNA and especially some secreted immunoglobulins. So they find out there's a connection between people who have some elevated level of all this and then even to the testicular testosterone metabolism. Some of them, especially the short-chain fatty acids, the butyrate, and the effects of other metabolites, especially the ROS, the reactive oxygen species, affects even the gut microbiome. In fact, there is a kind of a two-way direction, you know, what affects the testes could have an impact even to what affects the gut. And yes. Even saying what affects the gut, you probably have, especially the diet, you could affect what's happened. Well, there should be, we should be able to explain that, because the dietary composition of the gut, the diet, the lifestyle, toxin drugs, even all the probiotics and microbial regulators from the gut. And of course, they may have a direct connection to the testes. There are some hypotheses being propagated now, as they call it, the blood testes barrier, right? Initially, they are saying that it's kind of the barrier that is strong, but from recent studies, they have found out that barrier showed that there's a connection whereby some metabolites and some other microbial regulators can pass through from the blood and into the testes. So these are possibilities.
Kingsley, this has been really fascinating, and I really want to congratulate you on the level of science you're doing under such difficult circumstances. I think it's an example to all of us how, you know, you can really contribute even in the absence of a lot of funding, which obviously we hope you do get more funding as time goes on. But thank you so much for joining us today. We really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you, Kingsley.
Thanks.
The International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, also known as ISAP, is a non-profit scientific organization dedicated to advancing the science of probiotics, prebiotics, symbiotics, postbiotics, and fermented foods. Follow along with our activities by searching for ISAP Science on your social media platform of choice, or visit www.isapscience.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.